Saleh, and this is Living History. This show explores the rich heritage of the Brandywine Valley outside Philadelphia, focusing on the people, places, and events over more than 300 years, which have played an important part in our American heritage. Each show highlights a local town, event, or personality who's had a notable influence on our culture. And before we get started, I want to mention that our call-in line, if you have questions or comments, is 610-701-9243. That's 610-701-9243. This day in history, March 15th. In 44 BC, Julius Caesar is murdered by his own senators in Rome in a plot developed by one of his closest supporters, Marcus Brutus, an event captured centuries later in a play by William Shakespeare depicting the horrific actions on this day called the Ides of March. In 1820, Maine is admitted to the Union as a free state to complement and balance the admission of Missouri as a slave state allowed under the Missouri Compromise. Despite the apparent calm and civility of the political move, it simply reinforced growing tensions regarding the spread of slavery as America grew and expanded its territories, eventually leading to violent uprisings, lynchings, and horrific bloodshed around the nation, which ultimately caused secession of several southern states and the Civil War 4 decades later. And in 1968, construction begins on the world's highest route through a mountain of rock, the Eisenhower Tunnel west of Denver, which stood at 11,000 feet above sea level. Situated along Interstate 70, the project was a continuation of a decades-long effort to provide safe and useful highways throughout America, the Interstate Highway System begun by President Eisenhower in the 1950s. Within a year after its opening, the tunnel had more than 1 million vehicles passing through its arches. It's a long-standing debate. What city is truly America's cradle of liberty? Both Boston and Philadelphia claim the title. Boston, because the first armed conflict occurred nearby against British troops. Philadelphia, because several meetings of the Continental Congress were held there, creating the Declaration of Independence, which was signed at the Pennsylvania State House, now called Independence Hall. Old Town Philadelphia is rich in history, with several buildings showcasing our heritage, including the one housing the Liberty Bell, Carpenter's Hall, the Bessie Ross House, Benjamin Franklin's home, the Old City Tavern, where Washington, Jefferson, and other founding fathers dined, and even the remnants of the house George Washington lived in during his years as president. Independence Historic Park gets millions of visitors every year and remains one of the most popular tourist attractions in the United States. Anyone who's visited Independence Hall and seen the meeting room where delegates voted for independence from England has felt the spirit and energy which helped create our republic, especially as they gaze at the chair holding a sun carved on its surface, which Benjamin Franklin famously referred to as a rising sun. Adam Duncan is a park ranger at Independence Historic Park who knows the rich heritage of our nation and the stories behind the scenes of these buildings. He's walked the halls, describing these events to thousands of guests. Adam is here with us today to talk about the park. Adam, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Gene, and good afternoon to you and all your listeners.
Oh, thank you. Now, tell us about your duties there at Independence Historic Park. What are your daily or weekly responsibilities, and how long have you been there?
Well, I'm a National Park Service ranger at Independence National Historical Park. I've been here for about 15 years. I'm in the public affairs office currently. When I first started with the National Park Service, I was in the Division of Interpretation and Education, and that division is responsible for doing the public programs, the tours of Independence Hall, basically the face of the National Park Service to visitors who visit the park here in Philadelphia. So my daily duties have a very broad spectrum. That includes doing social media for the park. I am the co-webmaster of our website. I do special attention requests for dignitaries that visit the park. I deal with media inquiries. I also do permits for what we would call special park use, First Amendment, commercial filming, special events. I also help with Freedom of Information Act requests. So on a daily basis, I never know what I may encounter each day.
Quite a wide range of daily responsibilities. Tell us about the range of facilities and structures within the overall park complex.
Well, Independence National Historical Park itself covers 54 acres in Old City, Philadelphia, as you mentioned. We cover over 25 sites, and that includes several other national parks, including the Edgar Allan Poe National Historic Site, the Thaddeus Kosciuszko National Memorial, Gloria Day Old Swedes Church National Historic Site. But the buildings specifically here at Independence range really anything to do with the founding of the United States and the early republic. You mentioned Independence Hall. The Liberty Bell also ranges to Congress Hall, the oldest standing United States Capitol building that was used by Congress for 10 years while Philadelphia was the capital city. Old City Hall, not only is it the former City Hall of Philadelphia, but it's also the meeting place of the Supreme Court during the 10 years that Philadelphia was here. We also have several other privately owned buildings that we don't operate, but they are included under our jurisdiction as a national park. That would include Carpenter's Hall. You mentioned that, which is the meeting place of the First Continental Congress. The American Philosophical Society, which was started by Benjamin Franklin. Christ Church, an old St. Joseph's Church. Now, old St. Joseph's, a lot of people may have heard of Christ Church. It's where Franklin attended services, Washington, and many other notaries of the time period. But Old St. Joseph's Church is the first Roman Catholic church in Philadelphia. We also cover Mikvah Israel Jewish Cemetery, which is the oldest in Philadelphia, and it's the resting place of Chaim Solomon, who alongside Robert Morris is considered to be the prime financier of the American Revolution. We also have the home of Bishop William White, the first Bishop of the Episcopal Church and chaplain to the Continental Congress and the United States Senate. One of our sites also includes the Dolly Todd House, where Dolly Todd lived with her first husband, John Todd, and he passes away, and she later meets James Madison and becomes First Lady of the United States. Also, City Tavern, what John Adams referred to as the most genteel tavern, and it happened to be one of the favorite meeting places of many of the founding generation. And we also include the Thomas Bond House, which today it's operated as a bread and breakfast, but it is the home of celebrated physician and surgeon and the co-founder of the Pennsylvania Hospital Committee of Safety in 1776, and Dr. Bond also helped to organize the Army. So it's not just one site that we cover. Independence Hall, the Liberty Bell are the big ones, but we also cover the first and the second banks in the United States. Hamilton's Bank at the First Bank is just one of the many sites.
Well, that is outstanding. You know, everybody asks about the Liberty Bell and Independence Hall, so I'm going to start with those.
Sure.
I know the Liberty Bell was not in its present location permanently. I think it's moved a couple of times. Tell us about the location of the Liberty Bell and a little bit of that, its history.
Well, certainly over the last 200 years, the bell has been in various locations. Its original purpose was to hang in the tower of the Pennsylvania State House, what we now call Independence Hall, naturally because of what happens there in the summer of 1776. But its original purpose was to announce the opening sessions of the Pennsylvania Assembly. Members of the Assembly, like Benjamin Franklin, and that was important because members of the Pennsylvania Assembly at the time period in the 1750s, at least when Benjamin Franklin notices the bell ringing. He's actually writing a letter to his friend Catherine Ray, and he says, "The bell rings, and I must go amongst the grave ones to talk politics." That was important. After 30 minutes of the bell ceasing to toll, a Pennsylvania Assembly member had to report to the building for their duties, and for each additional half hour they were late, they would be fined. So the bell is the original bell for the State House of Pennsylvania, but it takes on other roles over the years, notably because of what happened in the building in 1776. It would also announce other special occasions, holidays. It would toll for George Washington's birthday, and also toll when George Washington passed away. And so it kind of gets elevated into history because of what happens there in 1776. But other groups kind of adopt the bell. After it cracks for the second and final time in 1846, the city of Philadelphia, who purchased the building, the state house, from the state of Pennsylvania in the early part of the 19th century, so they actually owned it and own the building today, they decided to take the bell down out of the tower and put it on display where people can see it. It was already on the road of becoming the old state house bell or the Independence bell, and a lot of people at that time period just started to call it the Liberty Bell in Philadelphia. It wasn't until really the 20th century that the bell was removed from display inside Independence Hall, and that was for the bicentennial. On January 1st of 1976, the National Park Service move the bell out of the hall to put it in its own location. If some of your listeners remember visiting it between 1976 and 2003, they would have visited in its glass pavilion just on Market Street in between 6th and 5th. And then in 2003, the National Park Service moved its location just about 100 feet to a new building that I think is a much more fitting museum dedicated to the history of the Liberty Bell, how it's become our national symbol, and really an international symbol of the eternal struggle for freedom worldwide.
Yeah, I think that's got to be one of the most visited sites in Philadelphia, maybe in all of America. In terms of Independence Hall, millions of people have gone through there. What can you tell us about Independence Hall that maybe some of our listeners don't know?
One of the things that a lot of people are surprised to know is, one, all three of our founding documents, and you got to qualify that. What is a founding document? Certainly, we can make the argument of other documents that could be considered, but I think the three most important would be the Declaration of Independence, the Articles of Confederation and Perpetual Union, and the Constitution of the United States, all debated, adopted, and signed inside the building. One of the other things that a lot of people don't know is that we do have some Civil War history. Now, it's not our primary focus. However, not only was Independence Square an encampment, or I should say a recruiting encampment for the Union Army in 1862 called Camp Independence, it was also visited by Abraham Lincoln. At the time he visited in life, he was the president-elect on his way to his inauguration, and then his body, after he was assassinated, retraced the same exact route, and his body lied in state for 3 days inside the building. And then lastly, the other thing I think people should know is that it is one of only 23 United States in the United States World Heritage Sites designated by the United Nations.
That is fascinating. You know, I have visited there many times, and every time I go to Independence Hall, I feel just a connection with the Founding Fathers and the great events that occurred there. We are about to take a brief break, but stay with us, and we will return with Adam Duncan of Independence Historic Park.
Do you have a wedding, graduation, baptism, confirmation, milestone, or birthday to plan? You need John Surratt Catering, one of the most highly rated and preferred caterers throughout the Philadelphia area. They will be there to create and cater your event while assisting as much or as little as you desire. Planning a decadent, over-the-top company gala? Need help transforming your backyard into the party of the year? Want to wow your clients with a delicious luncheon? Then you need John Surratt Catering. All you have to do is call, and they'll handle the rest. Located at 835 Lincoln Avenue in Westchester, visit them at SurrockCatering.com or call 610-640-2836. That's 610-640-2836.
If you had to choose a roofer, would you choose one with limited experience and knowledge, or would you choose a roofer certified as a master elite contractor by the largest manufacturer in the nation, GAF, a distinction shared by only 3% of the nation's roofers? I'm talking about GP Martini Roofing, who also does siding, windows, doors, and offers an ironclad guarantee that he'll repair or replace any roof for defects within its normal life. GP Martini services Chester, Delaware, Bucks, and Montgomery counties with free estimates and consultation, and does both commercial and residential. Go to their website at martiniroofing.com for special savings, or call 610-873-1696. And also, financing is available with no payments for a full year. Now, what roofer would you call? GP Martini is the answer. 610-873-1696.
You're listening to WCHE 1520 AM, the Talk of Chester County. Stay tuned for what's next.
I'm Gene Pasale, and this is Living History. Today we're talking with Adam Duncan, park ranger at Independence Historic Park in downtown Philadelphia. Adam, there are so many places to talk about and really for everyone listening in to visit in downtown Philadelphia. It's going to be hard to get to all of them, but I was just wondering, do you have any interaction with the Old City Tavern where many of the Founding Fathers dined? I mean, a lot of people hear about the Old City Tavern, and I've dined there many times. I love the place. Tell us a little bit about the tavern and maybe a little bit of its history.
Sure. The City Tavern is part of the National Park here. It is operated through a concessionaire agreement with a very well-known chef. He does a show called A Taste of History about 18th century dining. His name is Walter Stabe. And the history of the tavern, it's really one of the favorite dining places of the founding generation. We know at the end of the Constitutional Convention, once they adjourn, they all take leave at the City Tavern and spend the evening there conversing amongst themselves really about what they had accomplished over the last 4 months. The tavern that you visit today is a reconstruction, a very faithful reconstruction. Unfortunately, the original burned down in the 19th century, and the National Park Service, through an act of Congress when the National Park was created here, reconstructed the tavern. And so it is operated not by the National Park Service, but by Chef Walter Stabe's organization.
Yeah, that's a great place. And for any of our listeners, if you've never been down to the Old City Tavern and you want a taste of old town Philadelphia, that is a great place to go. The food is excellent. The ambiance is just wonderful. Adam, I know you get a lot of questions about George Washington, Benjamin Franklin, and Thomas Jefferson. What about some of the other founding fathers like Alexander Hamilton? Do you get many questions or inquiries about him?
We do, especially recently after the Broadway play about Alexander Hamilton, and that seems to have sparked a lot more questions that we see. And from our perspective, you know, certainly Hamilton's a huge part of the history, especially with the Constitutional Convention, but also while he is Secretary of the Treasury, his office was here in Philadelphia, and probably his most notable while he's here is the Bank of the United States, what we would call the First Bank. Mm-hmm. And today it is the only building from that time period that was exclusively designed and constructed for the federal government. All the other buildings that they used in Philadelphia were borrowed or loaned to them by either a private citizen like the President's House site or by the county or the city or the state of Pennsylvania.
I've done a lot of research. In fact, just completed my master's degree in American history, and I wrote my master's thesis on Alexander Hamilton. And I have a picture.
Perfect.
Yeah, I have a picture of the First Bank of the U.S. In the book. It's an illustrated book about all the things he accomplished in helping to set up our financial system. What's the status of the First Bank building? Are they going to reopen it at any point in time? I think it'd be a fascinating place for people to visit.
Yeah, certainly it is in the works. At one time when the park was first created back in the 1960s, it served as our original visitor center, and it needs a complete rehabilitation. All of the systems, the environmental control systems, the HVAC systems need to be overhauled. We have a friends group called the Friends of Independence National Historical Park that is taking up the task of helping us monetarily to reach that goal of reopening the First Bank of the United States. So if anybody has an interest in that, just type in friendsofindependence.org and you can learn a little bit more about the project.
Well, I think that is great. And in fact, I'm a member of a group called the Alexander Hamilton Awareness Society. And I believe their president, a guy named Rand Chollet, has had some interaction with the people down there and is hoping to maybe have a future event there after it opens. What spot in the overall complex there at Independence Historic Park fascinates you personally the most? What do you find the most interesting building or spot there?
Well, that's a hard one because we have so many great sites. But if I had to pick one and only one, it would be the assembly room of Independence Hall, where the Declaration, the Articles, and the Constitution were written, debated, and signed.
That is a fascinating place. By the way, probably most of our listeners who have visited Philadelphia have been to Independence Hall, but For the few who haven't, I highly recommend it. Actually, this is a good time to go because it's probably not too crowded. It gets very crowded in the summertime, but it's just a wonderful link to our past. And it's a great place to visit. And quite frankly, you get the feeling that you have a link with history. You know, there used to be a show titled Lights of Liberty, which was kind of a downtown walking tour, and it was fascinating. I don't think you do that anymore. But do you have any program similar to that today?
Well, Lights of Liberty was a organization. It wasn't sponsored by the federal government or the National Park Service, and they no longer do that program. But today, one of the programs that I really recommend is anybody that visits the National Constitution Center. They do a program called Freedom Rising, and it's a 360-degree live theatrical production that really tells the story of the U.S. Constitution and the American quest for freedom. So anybody that visits the National Constitution Center, definitely check that out. It's a fantastic program before you go into the museum itself up there.
That is a great building, by the way, for our listeners who have not been to the National Constitution Center. It has an absolutely phenomenal series of displays on American history, and you could probably spend most of a day there, and you really learn quite a bit. Going a little bit back to the Liberty Bell, when was it first rung in public, and is it true that the bell actually cracked during one of its ringings?
Well, there's no easy explanation. The Liberty Bell has a very complex history. Most people think, oh, it was just a bell and then it cracked and that's what we're looking at. But it's not exactly that way. Before it gets elevated to the national and the international symbol that it is today, mostly because of the abolitionist movement, the Pennsylvania State House, the superintendent at the time that the building actually served the colony of Pennsylvania in the 1740s and throughout the 18th century, was the superintendent, his name was Isaac Norris. He actually orders a bell from Great Britain, Whitechapel Bell Foundry. That bell arrives in Philadelphia in 1752. They go to test ring it over a period of several days, what we believe out in the State House yard of what we would call Independence Square today, and it cracks for some unknown reason. They try to send it back. The ship's captain at the time refused to take it. They found two local metal workers by the name of John Pass and John Stowe to actually break apart that bell and to recast it into the bell that we now call and later would get the name the Liberty Bell. So the Liberty Bell that we know, not the British Bell, but the John Pass and John Stowe Bell, goes up into the Tower of Independence Hall, or the old State House, in June of 1753, where it rings really for about 93 years until its second crack that occurs while tolling for George Washington's birthday in 1846.
Interesting. Yeah, people who have gone into the Independence Hall site with the tour know that there's a chair with a sun famously carved in the back. And after the Constitutional Convention, which created our U.S. Constitution, Benjamin Franklin was asked what he thought that sun was, and he said, "Surely it is a rising sun." Tell us a little bit about that chair and why it's so special.
Well, sure. And just to give you a little bit of background before Franklin says that, you know, in the 4 months that the delegates to the Constitutional Convention met at Independence Hall and created the United States Constitution, a feat which George Washington calls a little short of a miracle, the debates of the convention got very heated at times over issues like the power balance between the large states and the small states, and also things like the slave trade. So during the debates, Franklin looked at the chair that George Washington was seated in as the presiding officer of the convention, as the president of the convention, and carved into that chair is a sun on the horizon, a half sun. And as the men signed the Constitution, Franklin is overheard by James Madison Madison, and it's captured in James Madison's notes on the convention. And I don't want to paraphrase him because I think it takes away really from what Franklin was saying. But he says, and this is Madison's quote, "While the last members were signing it," meaning the Constitution, "Dr. Franklin looked towards the president's chair, at the back of which a rising sun happened to be painted, observed to a few members near him that painters had found it difficult, that signers had found it difficult to distinguish in their art a rising or from a setting sun. He says, I have, said he, often and often in the course of the session, and the vicissitudes of my hopes and fears as to its issue, looked at that behind the president without being able to tell whether if it was a rising or setting sun. But now at length I have the happiness to know that it is rising and not a setting sun," talking about the birth of a new nation, the birth of the American empire.
Yes, from a notion emerged a new nation, and Franklin kind of encapsulated it quite nicely with the simile with the rising sun. I've been downtown numerous times, and I love to walk on some of the streets which still have cobblestones. Are there many of the old streets left that actually have the original cobblestones downtown?
I'm only aware of about 100 feet of an original stone cobblestone road, and that's not an actively used road. It's actually called it's a little stone alleyway just south. It's part of the park in a complex called the Rose Garden, and it's one of the many gardens that we oversee. And it's maybe not even 100 feet, maybe about 50 feet of the original cobblestone. But everything else, what you see here typically is Belgium block, and that was put here really in the 1960s and 70s just to kind of give it that older city feel.
Mm-hmm. Tell us a little bit about your website. What can people expect to find there on your site?
Our website covers everything: visiting hours, history about our sites, the buildings that we cover, visiting procedures. You know, if you want to visit Independence Hall outside of January and February, you do have to pick up tickets. They are free on the day of your visit. Also has a way to reserve the tickets in advance. We list all of our special programs, which change seasonally. If you need to get a permit through the park, we have press releases, park visiting statistics, you know, how many visitors a year do we get, our education programs, our school outreach, if you want to volunteer for the National Park Service and volunteer here at Independence, and also all of our social media links. We are on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and YouTube.
Excellent. And the name of your website is?
It's real simple. It's a link of the main National Park Service website. It's NPS, which stands for National Park Service, .gov/INDE, so INDE for Independence.
Oh, excellent. Very easy. And just tell us about any special events you have coming up in the next few months. We've got just under a minute left.
Sure. I encourage everybody to check out our website for a complete listing, but we have our Women's History Month programs going on right now. As we get into Memorial Day, we'll have some special events and programs for that. And also, of course, Freedom Week is our big time, a week before Independence Day, and leading through that entire celebration into the following week, including July 8th, the first public reenactment, or I should say the reenactment of the first public reading of the Declaration of Independence.
Excellent. Do you do that very often? Do you do it every year?
Every year since 1979, we reenact the first public reading.
Oh, excellent. That is great. And, you know, I have to tell you, every time I go downtown Philadelphia, I always find something new. So that is great. Adam, thanks so much for being with us today. That was really an interesting discussion of the park. Be sure to join us next week on Wednesday the 22nd when Sierra Fisher of the Delaware Humanities Forum will be our guest. Thank you all for tuning in today to Living History.